Thoughts were going up everywhere. My spirit rose. To Hanuman, first for rice, said Nathan, excited. The gruel we have been swallowing has been almost plain water these past few days. I quickened my steps. My stomach began heaving at the thought of food. Hanuman was standing in the doorway of his shop. He shook his head when he saw us. You have come for rice, he said. They all come for rice, but I have none to sell, only enough for my wife and children. And yet you are a merchant who deals in rice. And what if so? Are you not growers of it? Why then do you come to me? If I have rice, I do not choose to sell it now, but I have told you I have none. We ask for only a little. We will pay what we have. See, here is the money. No, no rice. But wait. They say beeswas is selling. You can try. To beeswas. We come for rice. Look, here is our money. 2 rupees. How much do you think you can buy with 2 rupees? We thought... Never mind what you thought. Is this not a time of scarcity? Can you buy rice anywhere else? Am I not entitled to charge more than that? 2 aleks I will let you have, and that is charity. It is very little for 2 rupees. Take it or leave it. I can get double that sum from the tanners, but because I know you, we take it. We give up the silver coins. Now there is nothing left for the thatching, unless we use 1 rupee or 2 from the 10 that remain in the granary. I put my rice in the sari, tuck the precious load securely in at the waist. We turn back. On the outskirts of the village, there is Kenny. His face is grim and long. His eyes are burning in his pallid face. He sees us and comes up. You too are starving, I suppose. I tap at the roll at my waist. The grains give at my touch. We have a little rice. It will last us until times are better. Times are better. Times are better, he shouts. Times will not be better for many months. Meanwhile, you will suffer and die, you meek suffering fools. Why do you keep this ghastly silence? Why do you not demand? Cry out for help. Do something. There is nothing in this country. Oh God, there is nothing. We shrink from his violence. What can we do? What can he mean? The man is raving. We go on our way. The paddy was completely destroyed. There would be no rice until the next harvesting. Meanwhile, we lived on what remained of our salted fish, roots, and leaves, the fruit of our prickled pear, and on the plantains from our tree. At last, the time came for the rice terraces to be drained and got ready for the next sowing. Nathan told me of it, with cheer, and his voice and I told the children, pleasurably, for the fields were full of fish that would feed us for many a day. Then we waited. Spirits lifted, eyes sparkled, bellies painful with anticipation. At last the day. Nathan went to break the dams, and I with him, and me with our children. Sunken-eyed, noisy, as they had not been for many days at the thought of the feast, carrying nets and baskets. First one hole, then another, no bigger than a finger's width, until the water eroded the sides and the outlets grew large enough for 2 fists to go through. Against them we held our nets, feet firm and braced in the mud while the water rushed away, and the fish came tumbling into them. When the water was all gone, they were caught in the meshes and among the paddy, shoals of them leaping madly, wet and silver and good to look upon. We gathered them with flying fingers and greedy hearts and bore them away in triumph, with a glow at least as bright as the sun on those shining scales. Then we came and gathered up what remained of the paddy and took it away to thresh and winnow. Late that night, we were still at work, cleaning the fish, hauling the rice, separating the grain from husk. When we had done, the rice yield was meager. No more than 2 measures, all that was left of the year's harvest and the year's labor. We ate, finding it difficult to believe we did so. The good food lay rich, if uneasy, in our starved bellies. Already the children were looking better, and at the sight of their faces, still pinched but content, a great weight lifted from me. Today we would eat, and tomorrow, for many weeks while the grain lasted. Then there was the fish, cleaned, dried, and salted away, and before that was gone, we should earn some more money. I would plant some more vegetables, such dreams, delightful, orderly, satisfying, but of the stuff of dreams, wraith-like. And sleep, such sleep, deep and sweet and sound, as I had not known for many nights. It claimed me, even as I sat amid the rice husks and the fish scales and the drying salt. Chapter 8. Kunti's two eldest sons were among the first in the village to start work at the tannery, and between them they brought home more than a man's wages. "You see," said Kunti, "the tannery is a boon to us. Have I not said so since it began? We are no longer a village either, but a growing town. Does it not do you good just to think of it?" "Indeed, no," I said, "for it is even as I said, and our money buys less and less. As for living in a town, if town is this, why, there is nothing I would fly from sooner if I could go back to the sweet quiet of village life. Now it is all noise and crowds everywhere, and rude young hooligans idling in the street, and dirty bazaars, and uncouth behavior, and no man thinks of another but schemes only for his money." "Words and words," said Kunti, "stupid words. No wonder they call us senseless peasant women. But I am not, and never will be. There is no earth in my breeding." "If there were, you would be better for it," I said wrathfully, for then your values would be true. Kunti only shrugged her delicate shoulders and left us. She spent a lot of her time making unnecessary journeys into the town, where with her good looks and provocative body she could be sure of admiration and more from the young men. At first the women said it, and then the men said they were jealous. Then the men too began to notice and remark on it and wonder why her husband did nothing. "Now if I were in his place," they said. But they had ordinary wives, not a woman with fire and beauty in her and the skill to use them. Besides which, he was a quiet, dull man. "Let her be," said Janaki. "She is a trollop, and is anxious only that there should be a supply of men." Her voice held both anger and bitterness and hopelessness. For a long time now, her husband's shop had been doing badly. He was unable to compete with other bigger shopkeepers, whom the easy money to be had from the tanners had drawn to the town. A few days after our conversation, the shop finally closed down. Nobody asked, "Where do you go from here?" They did not say, "What is to become of us?" We waited, and one day they came to bid us farewell, carrying their possessions, with their children trailing behind, all but the eldest, whom the tannery had claimed. Then they were gone, and the shopkeepers were glad that there was less competition, and the worker who moved into their hut was pleased to have a roof over his head. And we remembered them for a little while, and then took up our lives again. It was a great sprawling growth, this tannery. It grew and flourished and spread. Not a month went by, but somebody's land was swallowed up. Another building appeared. Day and night, the tannery went on. A never-ending line of carts brought the raw material in thousands of skins, goat, calf, lizard, and snake skins, and took them away again, tanned, dyed, and finished. It seemed impossible that markets could be found for such quantities, or that so many animals existed. But so it was, incredibly. The officials of the tannery had increased as well. Apart from the white man we had first seen, who owned the tannery and lived by himself, there were some 9 or 10 Muslims under him. They formed a little colony of their own, living midway between the town and open country in brick cottages with whitewashed walls and red-tiled roofs. The men working hard, some of them until late at night. The women, well, they were a queer lot, and their way of life was quite different from ours. What they did in their houses I do not know, for they employed servants to do the work, but they stayed mostly indoors, or if they went out at all, they went veiled in burqas. It was their religion, I was told. They would not appear before any man but their husband. Sometimes, when I caught sight of a figure in voluminous draperies swishing through the streets under a blazing sun, or of a face peering through a window or a shutter, I felt desperately sorry for them. Deprived of the ordinary pleasures of knowing warm sun and cool breeze upon their flesh, of walking out light and free, or of mixing with men and working beside them. "They have their compensations," Callie said dryly. "It is an easy life, with no worry for the next meal, and plenty always at hand. I would gladly wear a burqa and walk veiled for the rest of my life if I too could be sure of such things. For a year, perhaps, I said. Not forever. Who could endure such a filtering of sunlight and fresh air as they do? You chatter like a pair of monkeys, said Callie's husband, with less sense. What do you talk of, exchange, and so forth? Their life is theirs, and yours is yours. Neither change nor exchange is possible. Once, and once only, I actually saw one of those women close. I was taking a few vegetables to market when I saw her beckoning me to come indoors. I did so, and as soon as the door was closed, the woman threw off her veil, the better to select what she wanted. Her face was very pale, the bones small and fine. Her eyes were pale too, a curious light brown matching her silky hair. She took what she wanted and paid me. Her fingers, fair and slender, were laden with jeweled rings, any one of which would have fed us for a year. She smiled at me as I went out, then quickly lowered the veil again about her face. I never went there again. There was something about those closed doors and shuttered windows that struck coldly at me, used as I was to the open fields and the sky and the unfettered sight of the sun. Chapter 9. One morning I was pounding some red chilies into powder. Ketchup went the pestle into the mortar, crushing the brittle chilies and the seeds in them. Each time it fell, a fine red dust rose up, spreading a rich, acrid smell in the air. A pleasant smell, hot and pungent, which made my nostrils water and spurted the tears into my eyes, so that every few minutes I had to stop to wipe them. It was a fine, peaceful morning, not a sound from the tannery, which for one blessed day in the week closed down completely. Each time I paused, I could hear sparrows twittering and the thin, clear note of a minah. Into the view on the horizon came two figures, moving very slowly. I went on with my pounding. The figures grew larger every time I looked up. And then, when they were still a fair distance away, I recognized my daughter. I had seen her only once since her marriage, and since then a year has passed. Excited, I gathered up the chili powder and put it away, rinsed my eyes, washed my face, and came out. On the doorstep, I traced out Kalam, a pattern in white rice flour to welcome them. They approached slowly, as if their feet were somehow weighted, not with the lightness which should have brought them quickly to my side. Something is wrong, I thought. Young people should not walk thus. And when I saw their faces, the words of welcome I had ready died unuttered. In silence, Ira knelt at my feet. I raised her up quietly with a hammering heart. Let us go in. You must be tired. Ira entered obediently. Her husband stood stiffly outside. Come, I said again. Sit and rest for a while. You have traveled a long way. Mother-in-law, he said, I intend no discourtesy, but it is no ordinary visit. You gave me your daughter in marriage. I have brought her back to you. She is a barren woman. You have not been married long, I said, with dry lips. She may be as I was. She may yet conceive. I have waited 5 years, he replied. She has not borne in her first blooming. Who can say she will conceive later? I need sons. I summoned Nathan from the fields. The tale was repeated. Our son-in-law departed. I do not blame him, Nathan said. He is justified, for a man needs children. He has been patient. Not patient enough, I said. Not patient like you, beloved. Ira was sitting with her face in her arms. She looked up as her father and I came in and her mouth moved a little, loosely, as if she had no control over her lips. She was lovely still, but strain and hopelessness had shadowed her eyes and lined her forehead. She seemed almost to back away as I went to her. Leave me alone, mother. I have seen this coming for a long time. The reality is much easier to bear than the imaginings. At least now there is no more fear, no more necessity for lies and concealment. There should never have been, I said. Are we not your parents? Did you think we would blame you for what is not your fault? There are others, she replied. Neighbors, women, and I a failure, a woman who could not even bear a child. All this I had gone through, the torment, the anxiety. Now the whole dreadful story was repeating itself, and it was my daughter this time. Hush, I said. We are all in God's hands, and he is merciful. My thoughts went to Kenny. He can help, I thought. Surely he can do something. My crushed spirit revived a little. About this time, Arjun was in his early teens. He was tall for his age and older than his years. I had taught him the little I knew of reading and writing. Now he could have taught me and most people in this town. I do not know how he did it, for we could not afford to send him to school or to buy him books. Yet he always had a book or two by him, about which he grew vague if I asked questions and spent many hours writing on the scraps of paper he collected, or even, when he had none, on the bare earth. Secretly, I was glad, for I saw my father in him, although sometimes my husband would worry that he showed no inclination for the land. But when one day he told me he was going to work in the tannery, I was acutely dismayed. It seemed it was going to be neither the one or the other, neither land nor letters, which was to claim him. You are young, I attempted to dissuade him. Besides, you are not of the caste of tanners. What will our relations say? I do not know, he said. I do not care. The important thing is to eat. How heartless are the young. One would have thought from his words we had purposely starved him, when in fact, of what there was, he always got the biggest share after my husband. So, I said, we do not do enough for you? These are fine words from an eldest son. They do not make good hearing. You do everything he can, he said. It is not enough. I am tired of hunger, and I am tired of seeing my brothers hungry. There is never enough, especially since Ira came to live with us. You would grudge your own sister a mouthful, I cried. Who eats half what I give her so that you boys can have the more? The more reason for me to earn, rejoined Arjun. I do not grudge food to her or to you. I am only concerned that there is so little. He was right, of course. The harvest had been very poor. Shop prices were higher than ever. Well, I said, go if you must. You speak like a man, although you are a child still. But I do not know whether you can obtain work at the tannery. People say they have all the labor they want. Kunti's son will help me, he replied. He has promised. I did not want to be indebted to Kunti or to her son. She was so different from us, sly and secretive, with a faintly contemptuous air about her, which in her son was almost turned to insolence. He had inherited her looks, too, and the knowledge of it lay in his bold eyes, a handsome, swaggering youth, not for my son. There is no need to go through him, I said with determination. I will ask Kenny to help you. White men have power. Indeed they have, he said bitterly, over men and events, and especially over women. What do you mean, I said to him. Speak with a plain tongue, or not at all. He looked at me obliquely, with darkening eyes, but would say no more. A few days later, he began working at the tannery, and before long, Thambi, my second son, had joined him. The two of them had been very close to each other from their earliest years, and it was not strange that Thambi would follow his brother. Nathan and I both tried to dissuade him, but without avail. My husband especially had been looking forward to the day when they would join him in working on the land, but Thambi only shook his head. If it were your land or mine, he said, I would work with you gladly. But what profit to labor for another and get so little in return? Far better to turn away from such injustice. Nathan said not a word. There was a crushed look about him which spoke of the deep hurt he had suffered more than any words could have done. He had always wanted his own land. Through the years, there had been the hope, growing fainter with each year, each child, that one day he would be able to call a small portion of land his own. Now even his sons knew it would never be. Like his brother before him, Thambi had found the cruelest words of any. Yet they were good sons, considerate of us, patient with others, always giving us a fair share of their earnings. With their money, we began once again to live well. In the granary, unused for so long, I stored away half a bag of rice, 2 measures of dal, and nearly a pound of chilies. Hitherto, almost all we grew had been sold to pay the rent of the land. Now we were enabled to keep some of that for our own produce. I was especially pleased that I had not been forced to sell all the chilies, for these are useful to us. When the tongue rebels against plain boiled rice, desiring ghee and salt and spices which one cannot afford, the sharp bite of a chili renders even plain rice palatable. I was able to at last thatch our hut again. substantially with two or three bindings of leaves. For the first time in years, I bought clothes for the other children, a sari